turn of Al-Kufa Ubayd Allah ibn Ziyad told him to go to Karbala and to confront Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And upon returning victoriously back to Al-Kufa, he would be dispatched to other regions. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to rescue Umar ibn Sa'd. Imagine that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intends to rescue the commander of the enemy army. And this is very important in this regard, in the sense that this attitude of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to rescue everybody, whoever, whether friend or foe, is very much significant in the conduct of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Then, in a short conversation between Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and Umar ibn Sa'd, Umar ibn Sa'd indicated that, he was very much in anticipation of receiving such and such rewards from the Umayyad hegemony and the Umayyad system, the Umayyad hegemony. Then whatever Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam explained it to him never worked on Umar ibn Sa'd. Then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam gave him this reproach and indicated to him that upon martyring him, upon killing him and his men, Umar ibn Sa'd would never reach felicity. Wished for him to be killed, to be slain on bed. And this was an anticipation of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam that came true. What's important in this regard is that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended not only to rescue Umar ibn Sa'd, rather Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to rescue a human being, whether his friend or his foe. Those who were friends of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam were already in the line of Imam al-Husayn salam and in the camp of Imam al-Husayn salam. However, we find that those people who were on the wrong side, on the enemy side, on the Umayyad side, Imam al-Husayn salam wanted to rescue them. It follows that Imam al-Husayn salam was the Imam of rescuing everybody, even and especially his foes, because nobody would render the slightest service to Imam al-Husayn salam unless he or she would receive the rewards from Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, both in this world and in the world hereafter. Assalamu alaykum, Ya Abu Abdullah. Thank you. Assalamu alaykum, Ya Abu Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Husayn today and always. عليك مني
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جيروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا ساغلام استنبول
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds.
We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation of Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage. Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market. From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they're just representing their tableau rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that their colors are faded by passing the time.
Representing Iran's heritage and civilization for thousands of years, the Persian carpet has for the past two decades disappeared from many floors and walls. Producers hope that this exhibition would act as a wake-up call for Iranian authorities to take action and dust off all the challenges from the Persian carpet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore, they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Programme said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep, not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony, of human beings, is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing their minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, US President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the U.S. and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the U.S. doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the U.S. sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The U.S. should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry, and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true. When you're 60, why should you retire? I mean,
Why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living is going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Puriza, London.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, "It seems AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza," adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes, and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saipur is up, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the impacts of the climate crisis become starker, farmers across the world are rediscovering ancient crops and developing new hybrids that might prove more hardy in the face of drought or epidemics, while also offering important nutrients. We now present you an article written by Cecilia Knoll. The piece is titled Diet for a Hotter Climate, Five Plants That Could Help Feed the World. Over the course of human history, scientists believe that humans have cultivated more than 6,000 different plant species. But over time, farmers gravitated towards planting those with the largest yields. Today, just three crops, rice, wheat, and corn, provide nearly half of the world's calories. That reliance on a small number of crops has made agriculture vulnerable to pests, plant-borne diseases and soil erosion, which thrive on monoculture, the practice of growing only one crop at a time. It has also meant losing out on the resilience other crops show in surviving drought and other natural disasters. As the impacts of the climate crisis become starker, farmers across the world are rediscovering ancient crops and developing new hybrids that might prove more hardy in the face of drought or epidemics, while also offering important nutrients. Chris Smith, founder of the Utopian Seed Project, says, "You hear all the statistics like we've lost 90% of our varieties. It's only recently that I realized the greatest sadness isn't that we've lost that diversity, it's that we don't even know that we've lost that diversity." Here's a look at five crops beyond rice, wheat and corn that farmers across the world are now growing in hope of feeding the planet as it warms. Amaranth, the plant that survived colonization. From leaf to seed, the entirety of the amaranth plant is edible. Standing up to 8 feet tall, amaranth stalks are topped off with red, orange and green seed-filled plumes. Across Africa and Asia, amaranth has long been eaten as a vegetable, whereas indigenous Americans also ate the plant's seed, a pseudo-cereal like buckwheat. While amaranth leaves can be sautéed or cooked in a stir-fry, the seed is commonly toasted and then eaten with honey or milk. A complete protein with all 9 essential amino acids, amaranth is a good source of vitamins and antioxidants. In the Americas, Spanish colonizers banned the Aztecs and Maya from growing amaranth when they arrived on the continent. However, the plant continued to grow as a weed and many farmers saved amaranth seeds, passing them down for generations, until their descendants were allowed to grow it once again. Today, indigenous farmers in Guatemala, Mexico and the United States are collaborating to grow this drought-resistant crop. Like fonio, an African grain, amaranth is not a new crop, but one that is experiencing a resurgence as communities adapt to climate crisis. Matthew Blair, a professor at Tennessee State University and co-president of the Amaranth Institute, says, "Everything that's new was old once." Amaranth has found its way into European kitchens as well, with Ukraine coming in as the crop's largest producer on the European continent. Fonio, the drought-resistant traditional grain. For thousands of years, farmers across West Africa have cultivated fonio, a kind of millet that tastes like a slightly nuttier couscous or quinoa. Historically, fonio is considered to be Africa's oldest cultivated cereal and was regarded by some as the food of chiefs or kings. In countries such as Senegal, Burkina Faso, and Mali, fonio would be served on holy days, like at weddings and during the month of Ramadan. Today, attention is increasingly focused on fonio for its resilience and health benefits. As the climate continues to change, fonio's drought resistance and ability to grow in poor soil has made it a standout crop in water-scarce regions. It also has important nutritional value as a low glycemic, gluten-free grain, making it a good source of amino acids for people with diabetes or glutton intolerance. While Europeans once called fonio hungry rice, European companies are now manufacturing their own fonio. The Italian company Oberfood helped introduce Fonio to the European Union in December of 2018. And in the United States, the Senegalese chef, Pierre Thiam, sources Fonio from the aid organization SOS Sahel for his brand Yolele, also the name of his cookbook celebrating West African cuisine. Cowpeas, the fully edible plant. In the 1940s, more than 5 million acres of cowpeas were grown in the United States, the majority, as their name suggests, for hay to feed livestock. But long before cowpeas, also called southern peas or black-eyed peas, came to the Americas, they were grown for human consumption in West Africa. Although cowpea production has declined in the United States in recent decades, the crop is hugely important in much of Africa. Nigeria is the world's largest cowpea producer. As scientists look for alternative crops, Matthew Blair says, it was important to identify ones where the entire plant is edible. Although historically people have mostly eaten cowpea seeds, the leaves and pods are also a good source of protein. Because cowpeas are highly drought-tolerant, they're also a good candidate as the climate changes. At Tennessee State University, Matthew Blair is part of a team studying the introduction of cowpeas to Latin America as an alternative to beans, like pinto and black beans, with similar flavor profiles that may soon become more difficult to grow. Taro, adapting the tropical crop for colder climates. In the tropics of Southeast Asia and Polynesia, taro has long been grown as a root vegetable, not unlike potato. But as rising temperatures threaten cultivation of the crop in its natural habitat, farmers in the continental United States are trying to adapt the tropical perennial to grow as a temperate annual, because it cannot survive the cold of US winters. At the Utopian Seed Project in North Carolina, founder Chris Smith and his team have been experimenting with tropical crops, looking for ways to help the plants survive the winter in the United States. Today, they're growing 8 varieties of taro, including ones sourced from Korea, the Philippines, Hawaii, China, and Puerto Rico. Chris Smith says, "We want to introduce taro because we truly believe that will give us a more secure food system. But the beautiful byproduct is that also allows us to engage with foods that are traditionally from either indigenous or peasant farming communities. And I think it really gives those traditionally underserved populations an opportunity to engage with the food system that they don't usually get. Like fonio, amaranth and cowpeas, taro isn't a new crop, it's just new to the United States food system. Which is why the Utopian Seed Project isn't just learning how to grow taro, but also teaching people how to cook it. Chris Smith says, these crops are just foods that are embedded in cultures around the world in a way that they're not embedded here. He adds, it takes work to build that community and desire for the crop. Kernza, the crop bred for the climate crisis. While many alternative crops are just plants that were grown somewhere else in the world generations ago, others have been cultivated specifically to withstand climate change. In the 1980s, researchers at the Pennsylvania-based Rodale Institute identified a wheat-like grass called intermediate wheatgrass as a perennial cereal crop that could be developed as a substitute for annual grains like wheat. The goal was to minimize the environmental impact of grain production. In 2019, the Kansas-based Land Institute, a non-profit research organization focused on sustainable agriculture, introduced Kernza, a cereal crop developed from intermediate wheatgrass and trademarked to ensure farmers know they've bought seeds from the official breeding programme. Although researchers are still working to improve the grain's yield, farmers in Minnesota, in Kansas and in Montana are today growing nearly 4,000 acres of kernza. Tessa Peters, Director of Crop Stewardship at the Land Institute, says, "Growers immediately understand the benefits of perennials on their landscapes, and for those working in grain-producing areas, kernza is very appealing."
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an introduction to the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, and ulama. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakhrouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum and thank you.
At the very beginning of this program, I would like to express my condolences on behalf of myself and all the staff of Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, for the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. That's why I decided to dedicate this series of the program in the month of Muharram and Safar to the scholars whose one of works, at least, is about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Qaini Mujtahid Birjandi, mainly also known as Muhammad Baqir Ayati and Muhaddis Birjandi, the author of the magnum opus Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharayat al-Manba. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the biography of Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Also, I would like to express my condolences on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions. Regarding Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi, we have to say that this outstanding sheikh is born to a religious family in one of the villages of Birjand, which is located in the east of Iran. Then when he was 12 years old, he goes to Qa'en, actually the very good or the closest place for the studying near to their villages. And then from there, he moves to three religious cities, starting from Mashhad. Then till he is 20 years old, he stays in Mashhad. And then from then, he goes to Najaf, stays for a couple of years over there, benefiting from the great ulama, Mirza Habibullah Rashti.
Yes.
And also Marhum Akhund Khurasani. You know, to have the name of these great scholars as your teachers, it will express that where you are, I mean, how you have benefited from the knowledge of the great ulama of Islam. And then he moves to Samira. So we have a sheikh who has compiled the experiences and knowledge, yes, of the scholars of three main cities for, yes, Shias, namely Mashhad, Najaf, and also Samira. And when he was in Samira, he benefited from the founder of the seminary of Samira, Mirza Shirazi,
that's right.
Yes, and then, okay, he comes back. When he is done with his study, he comes back to Iran and start his lessons and also going up the member. And the main book that today, inshallah, we have dedicated our program with, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Shara'at al-Member, is talking about the rituals, customs, and adab of the member. All for the one who is going up the member and those who are benefiting from the member.
They say that he had also mastery over the fatwas, we can say, verdicts of the other denominations of Islam, up to an extent that he establishes dialogue and conversations with them, answering them based on their own reasonings and their own books. It shows that he was really high caliber Ayatollah and Shaykh on that time. But as I said, since we are in the month of Muharram, and we want to talk more about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we are looking for an excuse to talk about him. What the best excuse than an author who compiled a work, or it's better to say his magnum opus, on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Dr. Fakhruhani, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Shara'at al-Minbar, we can say is the outstanding work of this man, Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi. What is this book exactly?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sallallahu alayki wa abdullah, assalamu alayki wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. One of the outstanding features of the Shia denomination in the whole Islamic world is that a member isn't merely a pulpit or isn't merely a podium for delivering lectures. Rather, member is a place or a space given to a high-ranking cleric, Shia cleric, in order to educate people, in order to give them informal education. Education can be divided into formal education, as one may receive in high schools or universities, in contrast to informal education, which can be gained, in the mosques, masajid, or Husseinias and so on. From this perspective, it must be indicated that when such a great dignitary like the late Ayatollah Qaini Birjandi, dedicated a book on the qualifications or the necessary traits that any cleric must have in order to deliver a set of lectures on religious topics. While ascending to member, it indicates that this space shouldn't be left without its own standards. Rather, it must be quite well disciplined.
Especially when it is about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because the passionate aspect of the story of Karbala
and
there.
It proves more influential for people.
Yes.
Okay. Because, ordinary people may not accept anything when you say to them in the street. However, when they receive the same piece of information while listening to a lecture given to them from the top of a member, they would, in a great majority of cases, they accept.
Okay.
In this book, Kibrit al-Ahmar has got two main sections.
Yes.
Two major sections. One of them is concerned with the qualifications and status of member, and another one is the benefit and the virtues of giving advice to other people. Backed and supported by Quranic verses or authentic hadiths. And then another one, second chapter of the book talks about who may have the qualification, the right qualification, both from the point of piety or from the point of knowledge, to ascend a member in order to deliver a lecture from there.
That's all right.
The third chapter of the book talks about...
So there are two parts. Part one consists of four chapters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Chapter three talks about... the qualifications expected from the audience to have. They must be ready. They must be state of alacrity in order to receive these lectures.
Okay.
And mainly, what must be observed in any commemorative session held in memory of the Ahlul Bayt. And the fourth chapter of the book talks about, I mean, various qualifications expected from a well-designed member in order to be influential for people.
That's all right. Yes. And the second part, I think we have some pieces of advice, you know, how to preach for Imam al-Hussein or something like that.
Yes. In the second part of the book, I mean, three important, I mean, topics or, I mean, standards are given in that, how, for example, the sad aspects of the, I mean, life and times of the infallibles should be given. Mm-hmm. Another one is concerned with, I mean, some other characteristics are concerned with the, I mean, guidance-oriented aspects of delivering lectures and how to manage,
a nice ceremony for Imam al-Hussein.
Yes, for example, university professors, when they enter their own classes, must be able how to start the lecture, how to develop the topic, and how to come to a conclusion at the end of the session.
That's all right.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من
Sheikh Mahtavi, we can say in this way the member and giving a speech on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on a pulpit, but the orators and we can say the speakers and the presenters, is really a serious task, as Ayatollah Birjandi believed in, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. That is a serious task, and it gives more emphasis when we look at the position of Ayatollah Birjandi. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some average level scholars may author some books regarding Imam Hussein, but when you see a scholar who has reached the level of ijtihad and got permission from outstanding scholars like Mirza-i Shirazi for the ijtihad, then under the supervision of his ustad, that it is, because it is mentioned that Mirza-i Shirazi is indicating, or it's better to say Mirza-i Shirazi is offering that with this knowledge and this skill for you, it's better to start writing. Mm-hmm. And when he offers the first copy of his book, not specifically this book, but the one of the book, because his books reach 70 volumes in different field of studies.
Yes.
So with this position to master different knowledges and different sciences regarding the religious sciences, you see, we have the book regarding the how to observe the conditions and situation in relation to Member al-Hussein.
Or Majlis al-Hussein.
Yes, or Majlis al-Hussein. So it will emphasize the position of this point.
Yes.
That is not an easy task to be taken by any scholar any level.
So you mean it needs its own experts in order to go on member and give a speech, and not any, maybe not any type of, we can say, a scholar or an alim is capable or talented enough or powerful enough in a speech to give on member, especially in the case of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which we can say has the passion and the knowledge and the historical, we can say, knowledge is very much needed.
And sometimes we see that there are some distortion
taken
place,
and distortions, that's
in the history of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his martyrdom and his loyal companions. Okay. So you have to reach the level of expertise in order to differentiate between the truth and false stories. Mm-hmm. That's why we see one of the subjects that he deals with in his book is about the distortions.
That's continuing the path of his master Muhaddis Nuri on the book Lolo var Marjan, Lolo and Marjan, because that book was also about answering such deviations and distortions which found their way into the story of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and unfortunately sometimes on the manaber and the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are being reiterated, which are absolutely wrong.
and Mohammad Baghir Birchandi Council tries to answer such deviations, distortions and misunderstandings about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharayat al-Manbar. What does Kibrit Ahmar refer to over here in this title?
Yes, this Kibrit al-Ahmar, as we have the equivalent in English, Kibrit al-Ahmar, better to explain it for our listeners, means that stone that magician were looking after in order to change copper into gold. So it's a metaphoric name, although it's got its literal meaning, red sulfur.
Yes.
But the metaphorical meaning of that is that stone that they were looking after in order to change copper into gold.
So you mean Mohammad Baghir Mirjandi can say...
To make a shortcut
to
for
make
something,
a shortcut.
Yes.
Okay. If someone wants to get a member and being a nice presenter on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he needs to make his copper into a gold, isn't it?
Yes, and whatever he is in need of, he can find it in order to
improve yourself, is better to say. That's all right, really nice title. Dr. Fakhwani, anything missed about this book or Sheikh Mohammad Baghir Bijandi?
One point is that, synopsis of the book, or for example, a brief version of these books should be put into English.
Because
I mean, nowadays we find that in English-speaking nations, some Shia writers send members or go to the podium in order to deliver lectures. And in order to prevent them from making some inadvertent mistakes, it's necessary to provide them with this kind of experience, again, related or, for example, reported in this region of the world. Perhaps some of these, anecdotes or suggestions may help them not to go astray while delivering such lectures.
Yes. Especially nowadays that the members are replaced with some of the virtual, we can say, on the social media member or something like that. But we know that the member for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam needs its own qualifications, the starting point, we can say, the stories that are mentioned, even the eulogies and the elegies and the lamentations that are done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam have their own etiquettes. So all of these etiquettes have to be observed according to religious laws and Islamic laws. And if they are not observed truly, they are deviated from the right path.
Certainly.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Thank you much, Dr. Mohammad Fakhwani and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, about Mohammad Baghir Birjandi, the author of the magnum opus, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Sharayat al-Manbar, which was about the best qualifications, or better say, attributes of giving a good lecture on the manbar about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This outstanding man, that is the late Ayatollah Mohammad Baghir Birjandi, passed away on Zilhajjah 14, the year 1352, according to the lunar Hiji calendar, at the age of 56. His body, we can say, was taken to a Madrasa Elmiya, or Islamic school, Islamic seminary of the Birjand called Masumiya, and he was buried in a special chamber or gravesite, which is, we can say, place for them, and he was buried in the school, in the same school. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man and all the people who dedicated their lives to write and to work on the Islamic sciences, Islamic knowledge, especially about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, this true legacy for the whole Muslim world to learn from and to benefit from. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary who compiled a work, at least, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Assalamu alayka ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.